So good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rob Atkinson, president of ITIF. I want to welcome you to this forum debate on whether the Chinese economy is a good or bad thing for the U.S. economy and the U.S. innovation system. We dodged the bullet on the snow, so that's a good thing, and hopefully it won't start snowing before we end. I'm going to turn it over to Jimmy Goodrich, who's going to be our moderator today, and Jimmy will do the introductions and moderation. Just a quick note on Jimmy. He is the Director of Global Policy at the Information Technology Industry Council. He's had more than 7 years' experience working with Chinese and global stakeholders. He has spent a number of years in China, including with government affairs at Cisco, and also with APCO Worldwide, where he was the lead author on a groundbreaking report on Chinese indigenous innovation policy. So, Jimmy.
Thanks, Rob. So thanks, everyone, for coming. As Rob mentioned, this topic is very close to home for me. I've seen a number of U.S. companies seen tremendous success, but also failure due to the rise of China. So the topic is very timely. A little bit more about myself at ITI. I lead our China work. We're a lead voice for tech in D.C. and capitals around the world. We have a number of member companies. But the question that we're talking about really is the rise of China, looking at trade and whether or not that is productive or beneficial to firms in the developing world. This is critical for the United States and our growth, and there's been a lot of debate, not surprisingly, about this issue. We have four panelists today. Hopefully we're going to look at this topic in a little more depth and detail. Some, such as Professor Nick Bloom from Stanford, argued that in the paper that that's linked to in the website, argue that China's development is productive and increases competitiveness amongst firms in the developed world, and particularly his studies looking at Europe. Others are arguing that some of the trade protectionist policies and restrictive barriers that China have enacted are actually degrading the innovative and competitive capability of firms in the United States. So, I'll just briefly introduce our four panelists. Today we have President Rob Atkinson of ITIF, lead foremost thinker on innovation and economic policy, long background in tech policy issues. Also put out a recent book on innovation economics, very relevant for today's discussion, and participating in the U.S.-China Innovation Dialogue, leading the experts group. Also, we have Professor Nick Bloom from Stanford University, professor of economics, very well known. You may have seen his work, and he's had editorials or been cited in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, CNN, BBC. Also, we're joined by Professor Phil Levy from the University of Virginia. Previously, he was at AEI and Columbia University. Had a long career in the government as well, working in the previous administration as a senior economist for the International Economic Council, Bush's Council of Economics. Also joined by Ambassador Alan Wolfe from McKenna, Long, and Aldridge. Is a leading thinker in U.S. and international trade policy. Spent a lot of time looking at China and the rise of China. Is involved at the National Academies Comparative Innovation Research Project. Spent a lot of work out there. Long career in U.S. government as well, working with USTR and across a number of administrations. So today's event is fairly straightforward. We'll have opening statements from each of our panelists, and then we'll allow the panelists to ask each other some questions, and then we'll go into Q&A with the audience. So without further ado, I'll go ahead and allow our panelists to give their opening remarks. So, Nick?
Okay. Thanks, Jimmy. Good evening. So I was going to structure my...
Thank you.
I was going to...
Wait, hello.
Okay. At this point. Thank you. I was going to structure my... If I shout loud enough...
No, I'll try this one.
I was going to structure my remarks around two themes. One is, I guess, the kind of narrow theme of has China impacted innovation in the West? And then stepping back more broadly, is Chinese trade and Chinese growth good for the U.S.? Now, starting with innovation, if you look at the literature of innovation, the theory is very ambiguous. So on the one hand, you have people like Ken Arrow who is the Stanford Nobel Prize winner, arguing that, look, competition and trade is good for innovation because it forces firms and managers to improve. It's kind of innovate or die. On the other hand, you have people like Schumpeter, who argues that, look, trade and competition are bad for innovation. So Schumpeter's argument is it's monopoly profits and rents that encourage new entrepreneurs and new innovations, and this is what drives growth. So the theory's a bit of a mix. My approach has been to look at the empirics. I'm an empirical economist, and I'll tell you what we find. So we've looked at around 10,000 firms across Europe and the US, covering about 30,000 plants and now 6 million patents, which covers over 80% of European manufacturing and a big chunk of US manufacturing, to try and investigate what the impact of Chinese innovation has been on Europe. And what we find is if you look in industries where trade has risen, where Chinese imports have gone up, we find large increases in patenting and R&D. So firms respond, they spend more on R&D, they take out more patents. Computerization goes up, so you know they invest more in IT and more in things like ERP systems. And finally, productivity and management practices improve. These effects are very big. So we're looking at by 2007-8, China was accounting for about 20% of the increase in innovation in Europe and the US. And the question is, what's going on? Why is this happening? Well, the evidence can be best summarized by this a famous case study by Richard Friedman from Harvard and Morris Kleiner from Minnesota on something called the Last American Shoe Factory. So they visited a factory that made shoes, and they used to make pretty low-tech basic shoes. I guess like the shoes that I or maybe many people here are wearing, certainly the academics amongst us are wearing pretty low-tech basic shoes. And the Chinese came in and they cut out their market, so they were producing at a much cheaper rate. What did this firm do? Well, they decided to make alternative higher tech products. So when Richard Friedman went around the factory, they discovered them making shoes that had metal hoops in the bottom of them, a whole series of three metal hoops, which people were used to climbing ladders. So they had construction workers, they put hoops in the bottom. As they were climbing out ladders, they were much safer. This was an order from some large construction firm. He also said another run they had was putting in chips and accelerometers into the heels of shoes so you could tell distance and how hard the impacts on people's legs are. And it was taken out by a firm that was worried about the safety of its workers and, I guess, ultimately lawsuits. So basically, they're innovating, making new products. What did you see in the firm? Well, employment of engineers went up. They employed more guys to design stuff. Computers went up. They were taking out more patents. They also laid off some of the low-skilled workers. So, high tech went up, innovation went up, R&D went up, but the skill mix also changed. And I think this explains, the broad picture. So China's been driving a lot of innovation in the US and Europe. Now I'm going to step back and think about, the bigger picture. What about China, the impact of China on the US and the people, the general welfare in overall? Well, here there's a kind of pluses and minuses. So on the plus side, I've talked about innovation. The obvious other big plus is cheap goods. So if you walk into Walmart or Target or Home Depot, it's pretty obvious immediately that China is driving down prices. So the figures that people have estimated is China's reduced the price of goods by something like 20 to 40%, like really, really large numbers, very, very big impacts. And of course, that has a direct effect on our welfare, where effectively people that buy goods are 20 to 40% richer. Interestingly, this has benefited low-income people much more than, I guess, people like this in the room. Why? Well, people like us basically spend much more money on holidays, eating out, cars, apartments, private school fees. We don't tend to spend a large amount of our income share on Walmart and Target. If you go and look at the bottom 10%, they spend a very large amount of their income share on these kind of basic products, and they've benefited tremendously. So, one plus is innovation. The other plus is reduced prices, particularly for lower income people, the people that have been hit more generally by increasing inequality. So that's the good side. The thing that I worry about, and I guess I'm still a free trade guy, but I should explain, put the one side and the negative side is potential impact on employment. So there's a couple of papers that have come out recently, one by Justin Pierce at the Federal Reserve Board and by Peter Schott at Yale, that argues a big increase in manufacturing unemployment or the reduction in employment can be attributed to China. So how do they come to this conclusion? Well, they have a graph, which I can just tell you 3 points. So the graph goes from 1970 to 1999, and you see US manufacturing employment falling by about 1.5 million. You then plot that from 2000 to 2007, it goes down by 3.8. And that's 2007 is before the crisis, so this is, you know, forget what's happened in the crisis. Now, the question is, what's special about 2000? Why is there a big kink in 2000? Well, 2000 was the year that China got normalized trade relations, and in 2001, they joined the WTO. And their claim is, a lot of what's gone on in this is low-skilled jobs in manufacturing have disappeared. Companies have teched up, they've increased employment in high skill, but net employment's gone down. My concern over that, I guess, is around the fact that, citing another paper, Autor, Dorn, and Hansen, they've looked at what happens to these individuals. So they have done incredibly detailed work pulling out Social Security Administration data, labor files, a whole series of data analysis, and they show much of these loss in jobs has led to, at least in the short run, increases in unemployment and people retiring. Why? Well, think of who loses their jobs. They're typically older, typically lower skilled individuals, typically in more depressed parts of the country. So, you know, stepping back, on the plus side, there's innovation and low prices. On the downside, in the short run, there's, at least in the short run, there's increases of unemployment, reductions of employment. What's my view? So, you know, to summarize, to say my view is still very much pro-free trade. Why, you know, why is that? One is, you know, if it hadn't been China, China's in a sense a stand-in for many other countries. So Phil, you know, as an economist, you tend to look at group all low-income countries put together. The last 10 years, China's been driving most of the growth. We know, I don't know if people saw the piece in the Wall Street Journal last night talking about how China's now become so expensive it's pricing itself out of the market. Indonesia, Vietnam, other countries are coming on board. It's also the case that a lot of these low-skilled industries were naturally declining, so it's hard to tell what is China versus what is trade. But more generally, my sense is countries that have done very well, for example, Britain during the, you know, the empire period, or America this century, have been in favor of free trade, open markets. Countries that have done very badly, for example, Shogunate Japan, where it closed its borders for 250 years, or the Soviet bloc post-World War II, have been very much against free trade and in favor of closed markets. And so my sense is it's very hard to hold back the world, to, you know, protect ourselves against foreign competition. The best thing is to have free markets. It helps our innovation. It keeps our prices low. There are short-run adjustment costs, but in the long run, we know the best way to generate growth is by open trade and open markets. Okay.
Thanks, Nick. Now we're going to hear a little bit from Rob, reflecting on some of the work he's done earlier last year on his trade policy, looking at Chinese industrial policies.
All right. Well, thank you, Jimmy. First of all, I want to compliment Nick. I've been a You may not know this, Nick, but we cite your work often and usually in good ways. So I've long been a fan of your work and have a lot of respect for it. And I will certainly acknowledge that competition does keep people on their game, and you want a policy regime that encourages competition. But I want to raise three issues with Nick's, both his talk as well as his paper. First issue is really just about the fact that the study itself and some questions I would have about the legitimacy of the study itself. The second is whether we can apply those findings of essentially a positive European story to America. I would argue we cannot. And third, that whether we would have seen different effects, this notion of sort of free trade versus protection, I think is a very large misnomer. Much of what China does is the opposite of free trade. Much of what China does is what we term innovation mercantilism. So the first point, how legitimate are his findings? First of all, I compliment Nick on the paper. It's hard to do this work. I think you've done the best job of anybody on it, trying to tease these out. But a few things, I think. One of the points Nick makes is that Chinese competition leads to higher productivity. In fact, what he finds is that it leads to higher productivity within manufacturing, and that a large share of that productivity gain comes from firm death. So in other words, weak firms, low productivity firms die, they're replaced, the high productivity firms are left, and therefore average productivity goes up. But that's not really the right question to ask. The right question to ask is, did the firms that die have higher productivity than overall productivity? And if they did not, if they did have higher productivity than non-manufacturing firms, then overall societal productivity goes down. So you can't just look at manufacturing productivity. You have to look at the effect on the overall economy. Nick mentions that PC work. He mentioned the PC firms that do better. They adopt more PCs. Well, again, I would question that, because one of the things that happens with Chinese competition is production workers tend to get laid off, and firms specialize more in advanced R&D and management and the like. The production workers typically don't use PCs. Those are usually used by the management and office class. So you would expect PC to grow. Nick also asserts that patents and R&D grow. But again, what he's measuring there is not, he's measuring that at the firm level. He's not measuring that at the country level. We don't know whether those patents are growing in Europe. We don't know whether firms are doing more R&D in Europe. And for Europe, that's what matters. Policy is not about firms, it's about countries. So the assertion that these are correlated to or directly the same as country benefits, I think, hasn't been proven. Second point is really about timing. Nick's study ends, I believe, in 2007. And that's an important point because Chinese economic policy fundamentally changed in 2006 with the publication of the long-term strategy, medium and long-term strategy for science and technology, what's called the MLP. China shifted their strategy, and we've certainly written about this and talked about it. China shifted their strategy from essentially an attraction model of attracting branch plant manufacturing from all around the world with a set of incentives to a domestic Chinese-oriented, Chinese firm-oriented policies around moving up the value chain. So and we see that now with companies like Huawei, companies we're going to hear about, I would argue, very soon, AVIC. They're the Chinese competitor to Boeing and Airbus. If anybody watched the Super Bowl last year, you saw an advertisement from Haier, the Chinese appliance maker, Lenovo. We see it with their solar panels. So it's one thing to say in the 2000-2007 period, the Chinese were making T-shirts and shoes, and that was sort of a creative destruction process. I would argue that if we went back and looked at it again, we might find a different story. Nick talked about the fact that the Chinese impact was not really seen on technology-based industries, and it was tended to be more low-tech industries that saw the impact. I think we'll begin to see that. Related to that also, Nick talks about how his data show that European firms' profits declined. Now, again, their first initial response was to invest more in R&D, things like that, but I would question whether is a sustainable strategy, that if profits continue to be pressed in Europe, you might find firms not able to continue that strategy. You talked about trap value reallocation. I won't go into detail, that's a really interesting concept. But trap value reallocation only works once. You can only reallocate that trap value once, and then if you're under attack again, there's nothing to reallocate. You're just out of business, or you're shrunk in your business. Secondly, how do we know these apply to the U.S.? Nick talked about a number of studies. David Otter argued a quarter of our manufacturing job losses are due to China. The Federal Reserve Bank study that he cited shows even more. Our work shows that 65% of our manufacturing job losses are due to trade and significant share with China. So we know they've had a negative impact on jobs in the U.S., bigger than in China. The question is, have they had a more of a hollowing out effect? So what Nick's thesis is that the competition drives out sort of low-end firms and low-end industries, and then you reallocate those resources to high-end. And if that was what was going on, then I would be at the front of the line cheering. But I don't think that's actually what's going on. It may have been going on more in Europe because the European trade deficit with China, overall trade deficit and with China, was much lower than the trade deficit that the U.S. experiences, including with China. So what happened in the U.S., what happened in Europe, was much more about low-end firms going out of business, high-end firms replacing them and exporting to China. So we see that in Germany in particular, where Germany runs a trade surplus with China. That's not really what happened in the U.S. We lost all up and down the value chain. We have now a high-tech trade deficit of over $100 billion. So we didn't reallocate. We just basically shrank. And the last point is really about this notion of not all competition is the same. And Nick asserts I'm a pro-free trader. I really don't think that's a very useful term anymore because it forces you into a sort of Miller Lite commercial of tastes great or less filling. I actually think Miller Lite tastes terrible and it's probably more filling. But leaving that aside, I'm a free trader, but I also think that the fundamentals of free trade mean that foreign countries cannot discriminate. They cannot be mercantilist. For example, if we really think competition is good, if competition keeps us on our toes, why don't we encourage the Chinese to have even higher subsidy rates for their SOEs, the state-owned enterprise? Why don't we even have them even bigger subsidies to attract foreign direct investment? Why don't we encourage them to have an even lower value of the yuan?
Why don't we encourage them to put even higher VAT taxes and even higher import tariffs? They already have very high import tariffs, but if we think that's good for competition, go for it. And really, if we believe that, why don't we suggest that we increase the U.S. corporate tax rate from 35 to 70%? It's already the highest in the world, but at 70, you'll really incent competition. These guys will have to compete. They will have to do R&D. Now, obviously, you see where I'm going with the absurdity of this, but the point is, I think that you talked about Schumpeter versus Arrow. I think the way we need to think about innovation is it's an inverted U. Too little competition leads to limited innovation, and too much competition leads to limited innovation. That's why you don't see a lot of competition in the dry cleaning industry, a lot of innovation in the dry cleaning industry. There's no profits in the dry cleaning. You can't accumulate any kind of surplus and then reinvest it. So I guess I would just close by saying, you know, Nick, as an economist who supports free trade, I would imagine that you also don't support, you would oppose distorted markets through subsidies, distorted markets through predatory pricing, because economists have shown quite clearly and correctly that those diminish economic welfare. But somehow, as economists say, we shouldn't do that here, but if our competitor does it, it's okay, and it has no negative effects on our economy. But if we were to do it, it would have a negative effect on our economy. And I think in a global economy, we just can't separate those out. Those kind of distortionary policies in one economy have negative effects in our economy. So I'll just close by saying, look, more free trade is better, but it really fundamentally has to be free and market-oriented trade. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Next, we're going to hear from Professor Philippi from UVA, saying his views, and I think afterwards we'll have plenty of opportunity for the panelists to address questions that come up in the discussion. So,
yes, thank you. And the fact that I leave criticisms of Nick's paper untouched are only because I'll let you sort of build up in anticipation as he knocks them all down one by one. In the meantime, there's a lot of that going around. What I thought I would do is take on a number of fallacies that sometimes confuse this debate. I had thought I would do four, but I just had an inspiration for five. So let me start with the one about all distortions are bad, and therefore we have to react. If I were Rob's personal financial advisor, I would not advise him to go around handing out money. It's probably not the way for him to maximize his welfare, say to, you know, just toss $100 bills at panelists, for example. On the other hand, were he to choose to do so, I'm not claiming it would maximize his welfare, but I wouldn't object. It is a distortion. It's not what one would sort of necessarily recommend, but on the other hand, it's not necessarily bad for me. All right, let me turn to the four that I had planned to put out in advance, some of which inspired by the sort of very interesting work that some of our panelists have done. First, the claim that China is successfully scheming to grab technological leadership in key sectors. Scheming, yes. Successful, well, that's another story. We have to look for the evidence. So we have to ask, in which sectors is China the cutting-edge innovator? There are certainly sectors that they've identified as important, and Rob listed some of them, that they may well, at some point in the future, take over the production of large passenger aircraft. But that's actually quite a challenge. Even for the established leaders, it can be a challenge to turn out a nice, well-functioning aircraft with non-burning batteries. But you know, we haven't yet seen the Chinese master the art, and I don't think I'm going to grant them victory until we get sort of a little further demonstration. And I think what a lot of this comes from is misconceptions about how one grabs technological leadership. Does it emerge from a stated plan, which is then backed up by lots of funds? Or does it emerge from a fertile environment where you set the right conditions for innovation? I think an environment like that would include intellectual freedom, strong IPR protection, well-functioning capital markets, the ability for upstarts to challenge incumbents, and the ability for entrepreneurs to feel that confident they can enjoy their gains when they win. Do we have any of that in China right now? I think you could argue that we don't. And even in the United States, where we certainly do have all of those desirable features, is it usually the careful plan that's well-funded that prevails? If you look at things like, you know, who would have predicted that an upstart Google would beat out Microsoft in search, that Microsoft would have to turn to Hotmail, despite the fact that they had sort of a lead in things like Outlook. You get these sort of young, underfunded upstarts, but they've had startup success. Apple beating out BlackBerry, RIM, which had previously had almost a complete lock on the market. All of which is to suggest that the conditions, I think, for innovation leadership and the proven track record are substantially better here in the United States. Second, or I guess third fallacy, given that I added the one in the beginning, China's mercantilism undercuts the basic tenets of a pro-trade philosophy. This is a bit what Rob was talking about, with this isn't sort of free trade versus protection, that we're dealing with something different. We're dealing with innovation mercantilism. It's strange to treat this as a novel argument, since when David Ricardo, your compatriot, was making the initial case for comparative advantage, mercantilism was all the rage. It's what everybody did. All the fashionable governments were mercantilist. And what he was pointing out was there was a problem with that. That when you ended up with, now we'll come back to the modern age, if you have $3.3 trillion worth of foreign exchange reserves, you may think you've won because it's a big pile of chips, but what are you going to do with that $3.3 trillion of foreign exchange reserves? This is what China, roughly where China is right now. Well, you can buy foreign goods and services. Or invest abroad. You can't spend it domestically. It needs to be changed over. You did, your currency would skyrocket. So I think we would, and not only that, you could just sort of keep going and get even more, but then you increase your exposure to things like a depreciating dollar or increasing interest rates, both of which keep Chinese leaders up at night. So it's not obvious to me that this strategy is either novel or successful. Okay, fourth fallacy. Foreign businesses are helpless sheep being led to the slaughter. We hadn't really touched on that yet, but there is a very real thing. The Chinese do have their indigenous innovation policy trying to grab key sectors, and there has no doubt been a very serious effort on the part of the Chinese to get sort of key intellectual property crown jewels out of U.S. manufacturers. That's absolutely true. The question is, are those manufacturers going to just hand them over? Will they be sort of so bedazzled by the vast Chinese market that they will just sort of turn these over thoughtlessly? I think I have somewhat more confidence that these firms will make sort of careful calculations along these lines, that they will look to see, they may not send their latest generation technology to China, that they are sort of, those I've spoken to are certainly aware of this. That doesn't make this easy, and their life would certainly be a lot better if you didn't have those attempts. But it certainly does not mean that China is on the verge of sort of creating a new Silicon Valley in Shanghai, where they've got all the secrets and all the innovation emanates. And as Nick mentioned, we're also seeing evidence that the thing that might have drawn them, the fact that it's such a lucrative place to produce, is also shifting as you're seeing moves in wages. And that was the story in today's Wall Street Journal. The last point that I'll raise, in a desperate effort to stick within my time, is that the fallacy is that in its misguided devotion to free markets, the U.S. government has sat idly by as China has duped us. America, awake, enforce! And that, you know, if only we would sort of set aside these ideological predispositions, we would get out and actively do something about all this. Well, in fact, there's been no lack of eagerness whatsoever to erect protection against China. As of a year ago, the U.S. had 289 anti-dumping or countervailing duty orders in effect in total. 118 of those were against China, just over 40%. And what of intellectual property protection specifically? Well, I'm no lawyer, although we happen to have a very good one here on the panel, but my understanding is that Section 337 of the Trade Act is quite generous in this regard, that if you find that an imported product is being made with sort of illicit intellectual property and you can show this, the U.S. will block imports of that product fairly completely. And this is not just a theoretical possibility. This is something that happens with a certain degree of regularity. I certainly saw it when I was in government. And so if we were to talk about a stronger stance, we said, what is the policy implication of this sort of new wariness? Well, to the extent that we've had any novelty in enforcement recently, it's come from counterproductive showpiece exercises like the Section 421 safeguard tariffs against Chinese tires, which were not even supported by U.S. industry. These give the appearance of getting tough on malfeasance, even though actually there wasn't even any malfeasance alleged in that case. the president stated this in the last State of the Union. So where does that leave us in terms of policy towards China? Hopefully with a somewhat calmer, clearer view, although I don't think I'm conveying calm that much. But I think there are some subtle economic questions about the interplay between foreign investment, low-cost production, and innovation. I think Nick's work addresses those, provides some very valuable answers. But I think, you know, what, and if you look at the National Academy of Sciences work, there are some common ground here, I think, in terms of answers. You know, enhance the U.S. environment for doing this, for innovation. You know, focus on building skills in the U.S. workforce. Strengthen the global trading system where you can get accords to redress legitimate concerns. But I would sort of caution against some of the China paranoia that sometimes seeps in.
Thanks, Phil. So our last panelist is going to provide some opening remarks is Ambassador Wolf. Ambassador?
Thank you. First of all, thank you for inviting me. Great work comes out of this institution, and I appreciate what you do here. I don't know that there's a complete disagreement across this panel, but there is some. One aspect is that foreign industrial policy does not have to be successful in being innovative to be harmful to the U.S. economy. Secondly, Chinese officials are very critical of their own shortcomings. So the fact that their IP protection is not perfection, and it isn't, and that their R&D is not leading to a great deal of innovation, they understand that. Third, I don't think this is really about protection as such. That's not what is necessary. What's necessary are some of the things at the end of Phil's remarks, which the National Academy says pointed out. By the way, this rising to the challenge U.S. innovation policy for the global economy is available on the web, an ad for that. It's also, there's some copies in the back of the room. In the 1970s, the U.S. consumer electronics industry was largely wiped out by Japanese competition. Competing from a protected home market with government support, not clear that any manufacturer survived that onslaught. Did American companies get to stay in flat panel display? No. In 1842, the British decided to leave Kabul, Afghanistan, for good reason. 16,000 left. One made it out, according to the story. A doctor who stuffed a magazine in the saber wound in his skull to keep alive and made it into India. The likely innovation from that competition with the Afghan tribes was that the British stayed out of Afghanistan for about 160 years until they forgot about what happened and they went back in. U.S. companies, in a sense, became more innovative, largely by leaving the field when faced with Japanese competition in a number of sectors, exiting the business. And in the case of solar panels today, that's what's occurring with respect to competition with China. So the story is not entirely different. Not all foreign competition promotes innovation in any positive sense. Occasionally, the phoenix rises from the ashes. Apple is heralded as an example. And there are 700,000 applications or more. This is a figure that was from, you know, 2 or 3 months ago, so I probably understates it grossly. That provides some employment, presumably a lot of it in the United States. But it's proving very difficult to reduce unemployment in this country. Wage levels are dropping, while the cost of living actually does keep going up, Walmart notwithstanding. So not all as well in the United States, and a fair amount of that can be traced to trade. That doesn't mean we should close. It means that others have to open. We have to work at that. Innovation, by definition, is comprised of both invention and commercialization. That's a key point. And where the commercialization takes place matters. There's a feedback loop. There's something that you don't have that much invention necessarily. Also, in the commercialization aspect. Both are a cause for concern. Can invention be maintained if commercialization cannot be? Trade and investment distortions affect both where commercialization takes place and ultimately, I think, where invention takes place. So I see our task in this country is largely to focus on our own policies not allow the U.S. economy to become the residual of other countries' industrial policy choices. That may not be true in all areas, but in traded goods and not yet traded services, there's a danger that we become the residual of other countries' policies, industrial policies. The composition of the U.S. economy matters. That doesn't mean that we engage heavily in our own industrial policy. It does mean that we need to do a number of things that this report from the National Academies, which is 98% not on trade, if not 99%, call out, as Phil has noted. A lot of China's policies we don't object to, setting national goals as long as it's not just self-sufficiency, because not all countries can have an export-led growth. Funding basic research, promoting STEM education, granting locational tax breaks up to a point, investing in state-of-the-art infrastructure, including broadband, granting preferential immigration status for highly skilled engineers. A lot of the things that should be a matter of policy concern because we have to look in at our own policies, but they're not a matter of complaint. Now, there are a number of Chinese policies that are actually unacceptable. Industrial espionage, which is you can read about regularly in our newspapers nowadays. Intruders gained full functional control over networks at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It's a serious problem in terms of theft of intellectual property. A weak patent system in China and deficient protection of intellectual property. Forced technology transfer and location of R&D mandated to get permission for investment or other permitting or procurement. Use of state-owned enterprises to deny promised market access, as well as access to supplies. When rare earths were cut off shipments to Japan, it was state-owned enterprises that did it in the first instance, not a government mandate. Investment restrictions, relegating foreign companies to minority ownership. Local content requirements, denial of access, as I mentioned, to raw materials, use of discriminatory national standards, subsidies that distort international trade and create vast overcapacity. The notion that the impact of these policies on our economy or on any non-Chinese company creates a net benefit for the nation or the company, I think, is not a supportable proposition. And I've got 9 minutes that I yield, 9 seconds I yield back to our moderator.
Thanks, Ambassador Wolf. Right now, we'll open it up and allow our panelists to first ask each other some questions, and then we'll turn to our audience. So first, I'll see if Phil has any questions or comments on the remarks that Alan just gave.
I do, actually. Oops, let me make sure I get this back on in a way that doesn't screech at me. Okay. Yes, well, I as always, Ambassador Wolf's comments are sort of thoughtful and informed by sort of great experience. And I find myself in agreement with quite a few. You made the comment that you're not arguing for protection. The important thing is not to close our markets, but to get others to open their markets to us. What is the practical approach to achieving that in this particular setting with China?
Yeah, one would hope that preaching, the one true path that our economists do, two on the left side of this I guess you're on the right side, viewed from the audience, which is probably correct. As I say, the Chinese, you talk to the NDRC people, National Development and Reform Commission, and they recognize a number of the defects in their economy. So, you know, first, try that. Our leverage is very limited. One thing I would really recommend is that we understand exactly why something like Bloom, examined in the case of Europe. Why does manufacturing move? Why does trade take place? What is going on sector by sector? Where we might care, you have to prioritize where we care about it. So knowing why things are taking place and figuring out ways to counter that would be important.
Do you think that this, I mean, is there, do you see anything on the near horizon, you've got all this fabulous experience at USCR, that would sort of have the Chinese, you know, many of these practices that you describe really are very objectionable. Do you see any near-term prospect for sort of compelling the Chinese to sign an agreement where they forswear such practices or take new restrictions on state-owned enterprises, for example?
Yeah, one thing I would not do, which is contrary to our government, I would not rush into a government procurement agreement.
Mm.
I'm not convinced we would end up selling that much in China at present. What happened in wind turbines is foreign market share went from 77% in 2005 down to 10% today. And that was state-owned enterprises, who were the purchasers, utilities, deciding somehow all on their own that they wouldn't buy a single piece of foreign equipment when there was NDRC money involved. So I'm not convinced that that carrot should be offered quite yet until there's some greater reform and greater transparency in China.
What about a bilateral investment treaty?
I think that one ought to be, we have a model treaty which is based upon our treaty really with Rwanda. And there are some differences between the Chinese economy and the Rwandan economy, I'm told.
Careful observers have noted, yes.
Yes. Although there could be more empirical study. So it has to be tailored to the nature of the problems that we have with respect to investment in China. A major difficulty is the Chinese government's propensity to retaliate against firms that do not go along with their suggestions, and we have an interagency task force on enforcement center, which is doing some research. So they'll be maybe a little bit better than the U.S. has been in the past. Now that's to bring WTO cases, which again do not lead to restrictions unless the losing side decides not to comply with the WTO panel decision.
Do you worry that you might get expansive interpretations from WTO panels and that sword can cut both ways?
I'm not afraid of a WTO finding against us. If, you know, if Boeing had subsidies, then we'll comply with whatever is required of us.
Well, there'd be those
cotton, obviously. You know, I would prefer that we weren't paying off the Brazilian cotton farmers and instead reduced our own subsidies.
It certainly could be in the subsidy. You could also see, say, gambling or something where you could get more expansive interpretations. The other thing I wanted to follow up on in my allotted time was you made an excellent point, which is just because a foreign policy hasn't succeeded does not mean that it's been innocuous, that it could well have harmed us. And I think that actually is probably a very good characterization of a lot of Chinese policies, where we would be better off if they didn't do it for a number of them. These are not the equivalent of gifts. But what is the implication then in terms of whether we should imitate them? When you're having sort of, I would argue that for a number of these things where we've had sort of prescriptive national 5-year plans on where we will take technological leads, that was probably the area where I had the most question about the National Academies report. That there should be sort of more deliberate moves along sort of picking sectors. But maybe I misinterpreted that. What are the implications for whether we should imitate these policies that have not been clearly successful?
I would not. If we have a national interest in having a major expansion of supply of renewable energies, then supporting that with government money makes some sense. There are things in China that we should emulate. They're educating an awful lot of engineers, and we don't proportionally, in a much larger country in terms of population, we don't do that. They have at the high end, they have very, very good engineers. I mean, those numbers are a little inflated because a lot of the engineers are really not going to be innovators. But at the top end, they are really very, very good. And we have college debt or education debt of $1 trillion in this country. I think the comparable figure in China was probably zero. You know, that's a problem. So there are things in China to emulate. In this country, one-third of our R&D is federal, and that's going to decline. And of that one-third, one-half is DOD, and 90% of that is weaponry, which doesn't have commercial applications. So basic research in this country is bound to decline. And one of the things I would say in response to sort of Nick, competition from abroad, if revenues shrink, R&D dollars are going to shrink as a gross number. That's what happens with foreign competition.
Thank you.
Thanks, Al. Thanks, Phil. I'm wondering if Rob, you have any thoughts at all you'd like to expand upon and maybe continue your, I don't know if you call it badgering, but your questioning of Professor Bloom. Thanks.
Well, one question, Nick, I would have would be. You know, when you look at Europe now, you really see, in a sense, two Europes. You see a somewhat successful North, Germany, Austria, the Scandinavians, and a pretty weak South. And I wonder whether these dynamics from China have just played out differently in Europe, that the Nordics and the Germanics were able to really transition and lose low skill, shift to high skill. That's at least the story we hear from German officials, Austrian officials, and the companies. Whereas the story here in Italy, in Spain, even France, was much more about they couldn't transition. And I'm wondering, has your research been able to disentangle any of that?
First of all, I say thanks very much for the discussion. It was a fantastic discussion, and much as it might seem otherwise, I actually agree with large parts of it. Before replying, I was about to say, you know, the group of us were discussing earlier, China has kind of impacted everything. And I was, a couple of weeks back, had somebody came into Stanford to say, their company wants to give myself and another professor potentially $5 million for funding research in Stanford from China. We're very excited about this, and said there's three things they'd like us to do, and they started going through the things, and they sounded very easy, very agreeable, we're very happy. Then it got to number three, and number three was the CEO's son is applying to Stanford. I don't see this going much further.
Is that free trade or protection?
I say I was tempted. I mentioned I'm on the admissions kind of overall panel, which I didn't tell them. I mean, God knows what would have happened if they knew that.
Would have increased.
They would have turned up with the $5 million. You know, I think. So in terms of Europe, you know, so it's a step back. I agree with a lot of the points you made, and I don't want to come across as rampantly pro free trade, pro China. My view is there's a balance of effects. Net net, I think they're good. In terms of how this plays into Europe, I see Europe has a slightly different problem, which is, it's some extent related to China, but the primary issue is Southern Europe is heavily regulated, and it's heavily, you know, it's taxed, they spend too much money, they're too regulated. They should never have joined the euro, because German productivity growth going up by 2% a year, therefore German wages should be going up by 2% a year faster than Southern wages. In fact, the reverse has happened. So the Greeks and the Spanish and the Italians, by giving themselves generous pay increases for the last 5 or 10 years, have priced themselves out of the market. And it's pretty clear they either need to have huge reforms in order to get back on the productivity growth or pull out of the euro. And I'm pretty pessimistic that big reforms will happen, because there isn't political will. You're right, they've been hit by China at the same time as make life even harder. In terms of how much is relevant for the US and Europe, I was actually at the World Bank earlier, Phil and I were at the World Bank earlier today talking about this, and the World Bank's very concerned about China for developing countries. I think the US comes out in some ways best of China and LDC trade, because it's the most advanced, so it has the best ability to move up the quality ladder. The best response to China is to stop making cheap goods that they're making and move up the quality ladder. Southern Europe's more trouble because, you know, it's struggling to do that. If you want to see where places have been hit badly, go to sub-Saharan Africa. So sub-Saharan Africa used to have a big export region whereby they'd make goods outside of tariff zones. When China joined the WTO, their output fell by 50% because they were directly competed with. So Europe has its issues. It's probably been made a bit worse, but I think it's a somewhat separate track. I mean, it does, remind me that I'm, strongly against regulation, strongly in favor of free trade for reasons as we see in Southern Europe now. You're right, free trade is very nuanced, and it's probably a bad word to use, but Southern Europe suffered horribly from the fact that, everyone's retiring at 50 and, there's license Raj, Southern Europe equivalent.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with all of that. I guess my other
question, Nick, would be, in your model or your thinking or your research, do you try to distinguish between sort of what I think Alan and I would call good competition or fair competition and bad competition or unfair competition? We can just look at, for example, the solar panel market in the U.S., where the U.S. had 50% of the global share. I think they're down to 5 now. Maybe the ones that are left are a little more innovative. I would argue a core reason, not the only reason they're down to 5, is that the average Chinese solar producer is getting essentially a net 40% subsidy. Now, I don't care how innovative you are, how productive you are, it's pretty hard to compete against a 40% subsidy just right there. So, would you say that level of competition is good for the U.S., or is it more nuanced than that?
It's a great question. I mean, empirically, we don't distinguish between them. As an economist, it's always a weird thing thinking about when foreign countries give you subsidies about how to try quite treat it, because I guess if you position it to the man on the street, they'd say it's fantastic. So imagine I tell you, you're Americans, you're buying solar panels at $100 a piece, but somebody wants to come in and pay for $40 of them, so you only have to pay $60. How do you feel? You'd be, if someone wants to give me free money, that's great. I have nothing against it. And in a sense, foreign subsidies and cheap foreign goods is exactly that. They're just making stuff for us cheap, and the cheaper they make it, the better it is. That's for consumers. The problem is what it does to the other side of the coin, which is our producers, and this is where there's a balancing act. On the one hand, consumers, typically in the case of China, poorer consumers are benefiting. On the other side, they're getting. Our numbers, what do we find? So you raised an issue. I didn't go into it, but about half of the impact we find is what's called within. So firms are actually spending more on R&D. They're becoming more productive. And half, as you put it, is between or creative destruction. So unproductive guys, or lower, I should say, productivity and less innovative guys are exiting. New guys are coming in. I think the second half is an important driver of innovation. And, China's links into this for new firms, how they're driving innovation. You mentioned Apple. Another example came to mind is in a company called iFi, where I met the CEO about 6 months ago. I mean, being in Stanford, there's endless of these meetings with Silicon Valley guys. And the guy has created a product whereby when you take a photo in your camera, it doesn't just take the electronic photo, it immediately syncs to your laptop and is in your folder. So it's through the kind of broadband network, which is vaguely useful and has been taking off. He said the process was they first designed it with a production cost in mind. They knew they could only get that production cost by going to somewhere like China. He said when it was designed, they then produced a small run in Silicon Valley. And then when it scaled up, they made a large run in China. It's therefore hard to say net-net what some of these effects are. That product would have never been created. We've never got the profits and the short-run jobs. It's true we didn't get the long-run jobs. So that's, in a sense, where the creative comes in to counter-effect the destruction. But you're right. There's a lot of moving parts here, and it really is a battle between consumers, cheaper products, and producers who make the current products who definitely lose, and future producers who potentially get.
Yeah, I think we should just have a policy, though, that people who are members of AARP should be giant China supporters because they don't work anymore. The rest of us all work. I'm a consumer and a producer, and I guess that's where, Phil, I kind of question a little bit sometimes the neoclassical focus on consumer welfare, because it assumes everybody's an AARP member and that they're not also a worker or producer. So we kind of look at it as, well, those poor suckers who were making solar panels lost their jobs, but the rest of us benefit. But what we ignore is that the solar panel guys lost their jobs, the textile guys lost their jobs, the auto people lost their jobs, the suppliers lost their jobs, the spillover effects of the local restaurants lost their jobs. And so it really, to me, is, I don't think it makes sense to just completely just say, well, it's a consumer effect, and so we should be.
I was going to raise a reverse question. So Phil, actually, this is kind of Phil's point. We were discussing earlier in the day at the World Bank, but he raised the issue. Imagine in reverse, we agree we wanted to reduce imports from China. It is a tricky thing to do. So the analogy I give you, what happened in Europe. So the Eastern Bloc joined the European Union in 2005. The Germans decided to prohibit Polish workers from working in Germany. The Danes allowed them to work in Denmark. The Germans said, we'll keep these guys out of our labor market to protect ourselves. What did you see? Well, very rapidly, large numbers of Danish construction companies that are allowed to operate in Germany because it's a free market were employing Poles. So for Germany, it was a disaster. The Poles were working there anyway. They just weren't working for Germans. They were working for Danes. And so it was very hard for them. And in the end, they just gave up. It was clearly impossible to police this. first point was, you know, imagine we barricaded against China. The Canadians are going to get the Chinese imports, and in a sense, the fact that they have cheaper imports enables them to export more cheaply. So we're competing not against the Chinese, but everyone around the world. And the Germans and the British and the Japanese are using, you know, intermediate inputs. Like the iPhone you hear is mostly Chinese produced. If we don't let our American firms work with the Chinese producers, we're at a disadvantage versus other computers.
Yeah, just to be clear, I mean, maybe I'll speak for Alan here and disagree with me. I don't think either Alan and I, and I'm certainly not saying I want to have fewer Chinese imports. You know, there are lots of great benefits from Chinese imports. I can afford really great stuff that I couldn't afford. That's not what I object to. What I object to is their autarkic strategy to not import our stuff. They should be buying a lot more of our jets, our machine tools, are all of those things. They shouldn't be, you know, if they bought just the software they steal, we're talking $5 to $10 billion a year. So I just want them to buy things. I don't need them to stop. I don't need to put up barriers here. And I think the debate gets skewed as if somehow we're all just anti, you know, anybody who questions China is an anti-trade protectionist.
So, enforcement of property rights in China, I totally agree. So I agree fully on that. I guess my issue is blocking stuff coming in, but in terms of open markets and the way, I totally agree. And one of our biggest sticks that in order to get access to China is to allow them to have access to us.
But can I ask a question? That I know I'm out of order, so I have to appeal for special indulgence from
the
chair. So are we all then agreed that we're no longer going to worry about all these stories that we were just telling about the people who were in textiles driven out because no one is proposing any remedy for this? I mean, it's true, if the Chinese buy lots more software, that's wonderful, but that's not going to help the North Carolina textile worker. So those stories were sort of a red herring?
No, two things, Phil, to be perfectly clear. First of all, again, our view is not that we should somehow oppose creative destruction. Creative destruction is a reality. Our only position on that would be what we really have to do is we've got to do a lot more as a society to help those communities and help those workers make transitions. So, absolutely, if we end up just by real free trade, not distorted free trade, losing low-wage commodity-based production because that's not our comparative or Cardigan advantage, I'm fine with that. In fact, that's actually, I maybe agree with Nick, that probably fundamentally is a good thing. My only point is that we're not then getting into the high end as fast as we should. So we're losing the low end, not getting into the high end because of these Chinese restrictions and IP theft and espionage and all these other. And secondly, some of that loss on the low end was due to unfair trade practices.
Let me just add, if I could, we had lost our textile and apparel industry to a large extent before China really became a major factor. It went to Mexico, it went to Central America, it went elsewhere. And as Nick pointed out, the really serious effects that are demonstrable in a sort of macro sense of Chinese trade practices or Chinese trade are to be felt in Latin America, Southeast Asia, where they're not part of the production chain, and Africa, where the impact is just amazing. And, you know, you look at Australia, it's becoming the Argentina of the present, the Argentina of 1900. As its currency is driven up, they're very happy. Low unemployment, they're great. Trade balance is great. The federal budget is in great shape, and their manufacturing is disappearing. There's a recession in the southeast part of Australia because of the effects of just selling raw materials. So the new colonial power, in a really major economic sense, is China. They've replaced us and Europe.
So thanks, Ambassador. So I'd like to first ask one or two questions, and then we'll allow our audience also to ask questions of our panelists. Nick, your data is going up to 2007, and Rob, you've spoken about the 2006 turning point. We could also look at potentially 2008 and the financial crisis. China initiated a strategic emerging industries program. You know, it's identified seven industries, and perhaps previous to the 2007 period, it's actually opened up the funding and up to multiple U.S. billions of dollars is going to each of the seven industries alone on an annual basis. And so potentially we might see a different trend as they're moving up. But the convenience they have is the government also owns their customer base. So in China, you know, energy, rail, aviation, telecoms, you know, we can have some quiet directives and the government ends up funding the procurement of its own R&D success. So the question is that enough? Is government ownership of SOEs that's going to facilitate the purchasing of their R&D programs, is that enough to create competitive force that's going to create challenges for the U.S.? Also, you have, you know, foreign export, foreign aid money that they can tie to procurement of Chinese innovation as well. So just like to, you know, hear thoughts from panelists as to, do we see that as enough of a force to create the destructive power that we've been talking about? So I wonder if you'd like to give that some thought.
Well, I think it's not making any quips about this condition of Boeing right now, but I think it's very likely that what we will see by 2020 is that the Chinese aviation market, which is 95% of those purchases are controlled by the government, and the other 5% are properly influenced by the government. I would imagine by 2020 you'll see I'm just going to take a wild guess, half or less of the jet aircraft that are bought by Chinese aviation companies, will be Chinese made, Chinese owned by state-owned enterprises. Now, what's the effect of that? They may not be able to export those for a long time. You know, they may never get really good. They may end up like being the Russian jet, whatever that was, that nobody wants to fly. Sorry. But the effect is going to be that both Airbus and Boeing are going to have a significantly smaller revenue base than they would have otherwise. They're going to have significantly less revenue that they can put back into next-generation jets. And that's going to harm Europe, it's going to harm the United States, and it's going to harm the global aviation market. And let's be clear, it's not because there's a private firm in China that thinks, geez, we can make a boatload of money. They're going to lose a boatload of money. They will lose ocean tankers of money on this before they make any money. But the Chinese don't care. And so I guess that's where I go to Phil's point is, you know, that hurts us. So they may never get into export markets, but just the fact that they're not buying Boeing or Airbus, that is going to hurt us. And I think we will see that in industry after industry. We'll see it, or we're already seeing it in advanced, in the telecom equipment. We're going to see it in other areas as well.
You know, in terms of trade's impact on innovation, again, going back to Japan, the one success we had that I, putting aside maybe soda ash, was, but in a high-tech product, were semiconductors. And the problem was that there was an oligopsony. We could not sell. We were residual suppliers. We sold 10% of the market. And we convinced people like George Shultz and others, who were certainly free traders, Clayton Yeider, that something had to be done. And part of it was anti-dumping, because they were selling below, actually, right down to marginal cost, because they were vertically integrated companies. They didn't have to make money ever on semiconductors. They didn't have to earn anything. So anti-dumping was only part of it. We needed access to their market. And we had leverage. We used it. Reagan used it. And got access to their market. Semiconductors are one of the top five exports of the United States now, and pretty important to our economy. Would not have happened if we had not intervened with countermeasures, in effect, trade measures, which were not, the important ones were not necessarily just the anti-dumping, it was opening the market, and getting the Japanese, not to dump in any market. It was very tough, and it was only one case. One instance, one industry, and it's hard to replicate that. On anti-dumping, you know, we used to have a lot of anti-dumping against Canada. Don't anymore. The markets are integrated. There's nothing. You know, there's no dumping can take place. It's like across the United States. So when a market is closed, you tend to have dumping, even without the non-market economy methodology, you'd still have dumping cases against China. And, of course, the largest users of anti-dumping against China, not us, it's India and a few others.
I don't know if Phil or Nick have any thoughts on that.
If I could, I wanted to just follow up quickly because Rob raised such interesting points. I would just note the sort of very difficult and intricate calculus of who gains and who loses and how much of the cost, the airline example, and whether or not there'd be purchasers. Of course, I think if we went back and looked in the 70s, China was not a major purchaser of U.S. They didn't have money. I mean, they were a basket case. So it's a mixed effect, and these sort of coming and going that they've sort of developed rapidly, which makes them a major buyer, and there may be other things that are concomitant with that. I guess the thing I most wanted to take up was this bit about the Chinese don't care whether you sort of lose money or end up with this. That's where I would really take issue, that I think we've increasingly seen the Chinese do care. I think this is some of the points that Alan was making in terms of there has been listening, some among the Chinese leadership, but also among the Chinese population. I mean, look at the Chinese attempts to reverse engineer and create their own high-speed rail. You did get some public discussion of this when it went off the rails, as it were. And I think that's something that we've seen increasingly. I think part of what you've had, and I've argued this elsewhere, is that as you've had increased integration with China, one of the benefits, this isn't directly with innovation, but it's involved sort of discourse, Chinese attending U.S. universities, back and forth, and there's now a demand for sort of criticism, accountability, and stuff. Certainly nowhere near on the levels that we have in the West, but a far cry from where we were a couple decades back.
Well, and telling now the chief architect of that program is sitting in prison in Beijing for corruption. So that didn't go over too well. Now we're also talking about privatizing some of the railway enterprises. So, you know, if the government now owns most of the customer base that can sort of commercialize its R&D, is then the answer looking to liberalize its economy, reduce state control, and do we even have an argument that can help them continue down that path of reforms? Do we see any bright hope there? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that, Rob, or Al?
You know, where'd the money come from in China to do all this, besides selling goods to us and others? It came from not having a social safety net that's adequate. It came from wages that were depressed and are now rising. And I think any government has a balancing act of some sort and particularly in China. If the party wants to, the Chinese Communist Party wants to stay in power, then they have to satisfy the rising expectations of their own people. And with Europe in the doldrums, U.S. growth is not very great. The rest of the world, actually, a lot of places are not doing all that well. The domestic consumption has to go up. That could lead to some reforms.
Okay. So I think we'll allow some time. We have about 15 minutes or so to allow for questions from the audience. Before we ask a question, if you could just introduce yourself, that'd be great. So we have microphones.
Brian Kane, CCIA at MIT. My question is, you know, we have a lot of accusations about Chinese behavior. Is there anything we can do to get better empirical evidence? And I'm thinking particularly of the intellectual property area, where the ITC did a big study a few years back, and what it showed was very interesting, I think, that despite all this talk of industrial espionage, that misappropriation of trade secrets only amounted to $1.1 billion per year. And despite the concerns about the patent system, patent infringement only amounted to $1.3 billion a year, the loss to U.S. companies. Copyright, of course, off the charts, $23.7 billion. And trademark infringement associated with counterfeiting is $6.1 billion. So great disparities in the problems with intellectual property demonstrated empirically, but I think that also shows the need to get empirically at this whole range of problems in much better ways than we've been able to do it so far.
Yeah, the ITC came up with a figure of $48.2 billion total, and I don't argue with the subcategories you name, but that they were looking at only one slice: sales royalties, license fees due to IPR infringement in China. Cybersecurity is hard to this study not didn't look at that to that. So what is the effect of loss of IP through theft, as opposed to infringement?
So that's what the trade secret slice would be. Misappropriation of trade secret.
Well, I don't think that there's good data. I don't think the ITC has good data on it yet. I think it's ramped up exponentially. You know, what are the losses ultimately if what the Chinese were trying to penetrate in recent times has been aviation information. That was the Jet Propulsion Laboratory incursion. If Boeing faces earlier competition, for example, it's not just a closed market within China. They are successful. They use our technology. That's 10 years out. So how do you, you know, you that's going to be tens of billions of dollars if that takes place. The only way to study this stuff, I think, they do surveys at the ITC, send out a questionnaire, do surveys, have people come testify, talk to people. You have to take a particular industry and dig pretty deeply to understand what exactly is taking place. And that is not something the ITC is very well equipped to do in terms of actions that take place outside the United States. If you what's the impact of loss of the wind market? It's not an IP issue. But it's forced technology transfer.
It is an IP issue, Alan, yeah. With American Superconductor. You know that case? Oh, this is American Superconductor is an American owned firm, a spinoff of MIT Technology. They created the world leading wind control systems, both software and I believe some hardware. And their largest customer was Cinnaval, the state-owned enterprise making wind turbines. And they found out, lo and behold, that Cinnaval had stolen their technology without permission and cut off the American Superconductor contract, so they're not selling them anymore. And that was a massive, Cinnaval is the largest wind turbine producer in the world. So that's a pretty big number. And I don't think that number was in the ITC study because it just came to light about a year and a half to 2 years ago.
I was just going to comment. I worked a little bit with the ITC on that study, on certain parts of it. I agree with what Alan said on this, and I would note you're right that it'd be nice to have more data, but it's an intricate issue and it's a hard thing because some of what you want to collect on is sort of non-observables. So, and they have to just simply ask a company for an estimate, which is in a way sort of an accusation. Just to give an example, suppose I'm a producer of DVDs. Right, and I see that there's a million copies of my DVDs floating around on the street corners, selling for a pittance. And I say, you know, if they paid $10 for every one of those DVDs instead of $1, look how big my loss would be. But we could have downward sloping demand curves. It could be that at $10 a DVD, there, if property rights were perfectly enforced, you wouldn't have so many sales. So I think this sort of supports Alan's point, which is that you need to do a much more in-depth look to get a sort of an appropriate estimate there, and then figuring out what Chinese demand curves are across all of these industries is no trivial task.
And also on the cyber front, the liabilities involved in reporting some of those incidents that some of the shareholders might not even know about yet are tremendous, and so the legal protections around sharing that information have yet to be approved. So other questions?
Yeah, Matt from SAP. A lot of companies, high-tech companies like IBM, Microsoft, SAP, Siemens, they are opening R&D centers in China. So they are outsourcing their research, innovation, development by doing venture agreements with one of the Chinese firms. So they are they are hiring Chinese employees. And isn't this kind of giving away intellectual property voluntarily rather than Chinese stealing the intellectual property? So it's kind of they are forced to do this to be able to do business in China, to be able to penetrate into that market. they have to kind of give away their intellectual property.
Yeah, induced in one way or another is not a very pretty picture. Westinghouse on nuclear gave a great deal of on the come to the Chinese to hope to get into the market for nuclear in China. I don't know there was any force applied, and I don't know that Westinghouse had any sales. I think the major form of tech transfer ultimately is movement of people among the firms. If China actually protected IP, the latest R&D might be being done in China, which it generally isn't. I think companies are careful about what they do in China. Many companies, anyway. There's a feeling that Airbus has gone a lot farther than Boeing would say. They haven't put their latest stuff over there, and they think that Airbus has, and probably Airbus thinks the reverse. But the genius of Silicon Valley, in some ways, is being able to switch jobs without changing your parking space. And when China gets to that point where they have real intellectual property protection, they'll probably get much better technology from Western companies. And yes, there'll be movement among personnel among companies, not necessarily stealing technology, just they'll be very well-trained engineers who are innovative, and they'll do great things in other companies. And they're not there yet. A lot of their high-tech parks, which are vast compared with ours, mega parks, are real estate establishments. They don't have that magic that takes place in Silicon Valley or Research Triangle or 128 in around Boston.
I was going to say this is it's like taking on an ominously anti-Chinese theme. In a sense, the Europeans and the Americans do exactly the same. So if you want to get a good prices for drugs in European markets, you better do R&D. The French are famous for setting drugs prices based on the amount of R&D you do in France, and the British do the same for the pharmaceutical retail price industry. The Americans did the same for defense procurement. So British Aerospace, initially a British defense firm, moved a lot of its production to the US, and in fact dropped the word British from its name. It's now BAE because they wanted to win government contract. Why? Because for the same reason the Chinese. So agreed, they're doing it. Are they any different from anywhere else? I think the answer is not. I would also step back and say something else. There's a kind of fear that China's going to topple the US and somehow we're going to, I'm still British, although I am going through citizenship later this year, so I don't quite know where I am, but as in the Americans. A thing to put in history is America has been the richest large country in the world now for about 150 years, so overtook Britain around 1850. Why did it do that? It educated its employees more, and it had amazing, universities. And if you look at rivals that have tried to catch up, Europe tried to catch up, but you discover, like Japan, it's much easier to imitate than innovate. So Europe comes out of World War II, half of American productivity, almost catches up by the 90s, but can never close that gap, because to overtake, you've got to start innovating, the same in Japan. So my prognosis is running ahead 50 years, China's never going to overtake. It can close the gap, it can imitate, it will grow. Great for us, it's making great products and cheap products for Americans. But I think in terms of fear of some economic lead tail, the US is going to be there at the top for a long time. The only big risk for America is that they pull out of higher education. So the one big, if you look at the biggest risk to America, I don't think it's anything from China. It's the fact that our numbers of people going to college is flatlined, whereas the rest of the world keeps going up. And we used to be by far and away number one in education in the world in the 50s, 60s. Now we've sunk to, I think, 20. I mean, the most worrying number I saw is if you look, the OECD had these maths tests, and America was 20th in the world. Number 19 was Iceland, the country whose maths and banking maths is like terrible. I'd never trust Icelandic maths. America, there's China, but I think we'll stay top. But as long as we'll fight off any kind of Chinese challenge, as long as we stay true to education and elite universities.
Nick, just two quick things. One, I really think it's a red herring a lot of people raise. Like they'll say, well, you can't complain about China because it'd be like saying, the other side is a congenital bank robber, and I didn't pay my parking ticket 5 years ago. No country's perfect, but it's not about whether you're perfect, it's about the scale. So, perhaps some of that happens in defense or in
drugs, and which is controlled by, what we're talking about is massive, on a massive scale, on commercial. That's what we're talking about. Don't even talk about government, because the Chinese don't even import anything by and large from governments. We're talking about a massive scale, and that's the difference. Second thing, just on this notion of, well, we're going to be ahead. Again, we absolutely are going to be ahead of China in 50 years. We'll be ahead of China in 100 years. That's not the question. I mean, in our book, we have a chapter on explaining the UK industrial decline, because we think there's so many lessons for the United States. At the end of the chapter, we have this wonderful quote from, I'm sure you know, I can't remember the guy's name, well-known economist, because, look, we shouldn't worry about any of this, the fact that the UK has declined and has fallen apart, collapsed its economy, industrial economy. We're still richer than Zimbabwe. So I'm happy to say that we will still be richer than China in 100 years. That's not the question. The question is, could we be even richer?
And also, there's, you know, there's a perception that there is mandatory tech transfer requirements in almost every industry. It's actually, if you take a closer look, not every industry is that way. So, for example, in the ICT industry, very limited amount of tech transfer mandates, and very few companies have actually transferred their knowledge over to Chinese companies. But rail and aviation, there are more very overt requirements for firms to transfer tech. So it's I think it's industry by industry. Other questions, sir?
Just a question, if you could compare and contrast solar, the Chinese industrial strategy on solar versus wind in terms of a global strategy, and if in a sense they don't get double subsidies, because if they can keep, if the government can somehow guarantee cheap enough capital long term so they can take the initial losses at a time where both Europe and the developed countries, the U.S., are really getting into incentives to purchase. They're getting the double subsidy when they purchase, because they're getting subsidies which unfortunately probably didn't go to as many U.S. manufacturers as they might have, but went to the consumers. So,
I mean, I would agree 100% with that. For those of you who are interested, there's a report on the ITIF website called something like Green Mercantilism is in the title. I don't know. The world have put in place to capture that industry, and China again being the worst, just simply. And by the way, some of that also is direct IP theft. It's not as if the Chinese just developed these technologies on their own. As I mentioned, in wind, they've done theft. So, I would agree with you that the Chinese market for wind and solar would be significantly smaller if they didn't have these policies.
But in isn't one case where they have a major domestic market, and another one where it's almost entirely export focused at this time?
Yes, solar is entirely export, 95% exported. They're trying to change that, but that's where it is today. And industrial policy generally leads to overcapacity, whether it was Europe in steel or, you know, China in solar. If everybody says that's the direction we want to go in and we're going to fund it, then you get too much of it. And then you have some fallout. They'll have consolidation there in both wind and in solar, but our consolidation is headed towards the vanishing point in our country.
So time for one more question.
Do you see that the theft of IP from China is state-sponsored? Or are we talking private on private?
I think it's very hard to know. But I think officials in our government believe that certainly a not insignificant share of it is state-sponsored, or certainly state-enabled. The Chinese could stop most of it if they want. The Chinese government, if wanted to, I believe, could stop most of it. That's not to say that a ministry is involved in it directly. But if you extend that out to SOEs, as SOEs are part of the government, then you're talking about a very, very significant share of it. At least that's my view. I don't know, Jimmy or Alan, know more about it.
You know, some years ago, a French official called me and he said, I just want you to, this was the result of a squabble inside the French government, obviously, interministerial rivalries. There are 75 engineers in telecom companies, French engineers in telecom companies in the United States, who are funneling information back to France. And just wanted you to know, it was a government program, although private company engineers. And I reported it to various and sundry folks in our government who could not have cared less. It's very difficult to find the dividing line between Chinese government policy and company policy, especially when half the economy, if not more, is still state-owned enterprises. So, one has to believe that some of the cybersecurity attacks have got to be enabled by the Chinese government.
Well, I just know today an article came out in the Wall Street Journal regarding Iran and their hacking of the banking system in recent months, and how this matter has moved into the Pentagon. Secretary Panetta addressed it. So, that just recently happened. Well, this hacking by the government of China has happened, for years that we've already known about. Has the U.S. Moved this issue into, the defense realm to deal with it? Or is it a little bit more subtle due to, trade importance?
I mean, I would just add that, I think there's a widespread perception that it's a government-orchestrated campaign, and there's a lot of perceptions towards China that take that view, that there's this well-coordinated, highly oiled machine working. And I think that's certainly not the case in my experience in dealing with the government, and that there's probably a lot of theft going on of IP in a lot of industries. As Alan mentioned, it's not just China. It's a lot of other countries that are well known to be engaged in industrial espionage. So I think it's a matter of law enforcement. And if you look at, if China's not able to even go out and clean up pirated DVDs, how are they going to be able to go out and clean up very complex industrial espionage cases? So I think the answer is there's a lot going on. Not all of it's state-sponsored. Might be a little bit, but and it's going to take them some time to build capacity to actually start looking at it. I don't know if anyone else like that.
One additional point, and that is it's not espionage, but the Germans have Fraunhofer's, which are one-third federal government, one-third the lender, the state governments, and one-third private sector, and it's all for industrial development. And they have these Fraunhofer institutions around the world, including, I think, six or seven in the U.S. One is next to MIT. They want to know what's going on in the United States, and we're not actually very good at that. We don't have Fraunhofer's. It's sort of our fault. It's not espionage. It is, trying to keep up with the latest that's going on. There is cooperative R&D with China in the energy area and renewables, in coal sequestration, carbon sequestration. In the Chinese have very good data on cancer incidents that is very valuable to NIH. They're very good at genomic sequencing with respect to cancer. They're ahead of us. And so there are areas of collaboration. I mean, it's really not all one way. We've been talking about it as sort of the Chinese are here to gather whatever they can here. But there are areas for actually open collaboration.
And also I think that there's an increasing awareness within China's own companies, where you have one of China's major industrial equipment manufacturers, Sanyi, and their Chinese competitor, were engaged in a very fierce industrial espionage campaign. And it's come out in the Chinese media. There's a lot of government attention to it. And the government's actually going to take some of these people to court. So there is actually increasing awareness when it's starting to impact Chinese firms. So I think that we're going to see an increased enforcement of some of these cases as they impact China's own companies as well. So, anything else, like any final points or? Okay.
I'll just say, the remarks I would have given on the table in the back, if I had had the hour and a half to myself, on that, I might not have held you all here.
Well, I know we're already at 6 o'clock, so folks, probably looking to try and beat the traffic, although it might already be too late. So, Rob, I don't know if you want to say anything or?
You're good.
Okay. Thanks, everyone, and thank our panelists.